This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Not every day we get to make contact with the International Space Station.
NPR, this is Houston. Please call Endeavour and ISS for a voice check.
Endeavour, ISS, this is NPR. How do you hear me?
Loud and clear, Scott. How do you have us?
Ah, just fine. How are you, Mark?
I am really good. Katie and I are enjoying a good day up here.
That's Endeavour Commander Mark Kelly speaking from the International Space Station. We caught up with Commander Kelly and Flight Engineer Katie Coleman on Thursday. Ms. Coleman's been on board the International Space Station since December. Mark Kelly arrived this week via Space Shuttle Endeavour. Of course, this is the final mission for Endeavour and the second-to-last voyage before NASA ends its shuttle program later this year. For Commander Kelly, this journey has added significance. His wife, Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, is recovering from a gunshot wound she sustained during an attack in Tucson in January. He and Katie Coleman spoke with us from the space station, 200 miles above the Earth, and told us first about the mission.
We just installed the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer. It's a $2 billion cosmic particle detector, really a premier physics experiment that's supported by 16 different countries, 600 physicists. I mean, it's a pretty big project managed out in CERN, Switzerland. They've been working on this thing, a lot of people, for a long time, and today we got it successfully installed on the space station. It's a great day for science.
Yeah. Katie Coleman, what do you do with your time up there?
Well, I don't know where the time goes, but I'll tell you, it's a very busy place. We've got like 130 different experiments running almost at the same time, some of them, up here on the space station, and then maintaining the space station and also maintaining ourselves and doing some medical work, some medical experiments. Just to maintain your bone mass, you need to exercise about 2 hours a day up here. So I would say every day is a busy day and a great day up here.
This might well be your last ride in space. I wonder what your thoughts are as you look down on our Earth.
You know, the Earth's an incredibly beautiful planet. It's it's hard to understand sometimes all the conflict in such a beautiful place. You know, it is it's possible that this is my last flight. You know, this is a really hard thing to give up. It's very exciting to, and it's a be frank, it's a big privilege for all of us to have the opportunity to serve our countries in this way. So it's a tough thing. But to answer your question, Scott, you know, just looking down, we've got a very fragile and beautiful place to live, and we need to take care of it.
Do both of you, either of you, have any concern that NASA's no longer going to be leading the way?
You know, I think, you know, NASA is leading the way and will continue to do so. We are the lead partner on the International Space Station, and when humans go back to the moon and on to Mars, I'm sure it's going to be the United States and NASA that's leading that as well. As we move into more commercialization of the launch vehicles and getting access to orbit, that's still, you know, NASA that's leading that project and hopefully buying those services. And this is something I think that in the long run could mean, the expansion of humans accessing space. So we're pretty excited about the future for NASA.
Katie Coleman, when you look down on the Earth, what do you think?
Now, you would think after almost 6 months that I might even be tired of it, and I will tell you that it's always changing. You know, different kinds of light, different just discovering new places. I feel like I've been to these places, and during my time up here, we've had the earthquake and tsunami in Japan. The conflict in Libya and the flooding in the south, lots of things happening down on the planet. And it's hard to look at it in that way because when we look from here, it still looks beautiful and somehow remote. And so trying to marry up those two things, you know, the reality of how hard life is down on the planet for so many people right now, and yet our view is very, very angelic, really. And so it's hard to marry up those two things, and I'm not looking forward to giving that up. It's very hard to give it up.
Flight Engineer Katie Coleman, Commander Mark Kelly, thanks so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome, Scott.
The revelation this week by the president and CEO of the Phoenix Suns that he is gay comes in the midst of what might be a moment in pro sports. homophobia is being confronted head-on. Remarks that were often dismissed as just a kind of acceptable trash talk in sports are now being challenged by a few of the stars on court. Last month, on the same day that Kobe Bryant of the Los Angeles Lakers shouted a gay slur at a referee, Grant Hill of the Phoenix Suns was recording a public service announcement addressing the use of anti-gay language among teens.
Using gay to mean dumb or stupid, not cool.
Not cool.
Not in my house, not anywhere.
It's not creative. It's offensive to gay people. And you're better than that.
Grant Hill joins us from Phoenix. Mr. Hill, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And why do you think this was so important to lend your voice to this issue?
It's about words. You know, the most important thing is these words have meaning. And gay is not a bad word. But if you use it, you know, in a way that promotes negativity, then it is.
Get any flack for it?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I'd say you have you probably have three sort of groups of people. You know, you have those that get it and understand it and appreciate it. You probably have a group of folks who took it to heart. You know what? That makes a lot of sense. You know, maybe I wasn't quite aware. I'll be more careful in the language and the words that I use. And then you have sort of, you know, I guess for lack of a better word, folks that are just going to be ignorant.
Charles Barkley, great player, for that matter, I think a very entertaining commentator, who's not known for pulling his punches, said that he had plenty of gay teammates in the NBA and it was no big deal. Is that the case?
I thought I heard, you know, that Charles had said, look, he probably had played with plenty of gay teammates. And, you know, I think the culture of male-dominated professional sports, that whole topic, you know, can be considered taboo. Our president, as you mentioned, Rick Welts, announced and came out last Sunday, the same day that our PSA aired for the first time. And for him, you know, I guess the pressure was such that he's been, you know, he's been hiding this for his entire life.
Is sports beginning to approach a tipping point on this subject? I mean, as you note, you have what Rick Welts said. Sean Avery, the hockey player, says he's in favor of gay marriage. And Will Sheridan, who played for Villanova, says, well, I was gay when I played. I'm gay, and everyone knew it.
I don't know if it's reaching a tipping point, but I certainly think there's more discussion, there's more conversation about this subject matter than at any other time. And I think more and more people are more comfortable with coming out and expressing themselves. But, you know, do I anticipate athletes coming out of the closet now, left and right? I don't know. But I think it certainly is, you know, it's just a good start to be able to talk about it and have these discussions.
You know, when word got out that we were going to talk to you, we have a colleague here who pointed out an interesting statistic. You were just considered the nicest guy in the world. And yet you lead the NBA in offensive fouls drawn or taking charges, which is kind of the ultimate tough guy stat. How did that happen?
I think I was brainwashed at Duke University. And if you actually were in a position to take a charge and you didn't, then you would get in trouble. So even now at the old age of 38, which is ancient in the NBA, I'm still putting my body on the line and taking charges. And my wife is, she's like, look, you need to stop taking them. And I can't. I've been conditioned.
I hear that you and Jalen Rose have kind of smoothed things over.
Okay.
Well, let's explain to our listeners, our audience, Jalen Rose in the ESPN documentary about the Fab Five, University of Michigan basketball team, talked about why he didn't like Duke players. And, you know, I don't mind putting it this way. I think he used a kind of racial slur in referring to you.
Right. Well, I agree. I thought it was wrong. It was disgusting. But, you know, he called and apologized to my parents. And, you know, I think it was sincere. And so I'm willing to give him the benefit of the doubt and move on.
Mr. Hill, we can't let you off the phone without asking who you see in the NBA Finals.
Well, in my dreams, I see Phoenix. But
Well, let me have the rare pleasure of telling Grant Hill, I think you're wrong this year.
Yeah, could be. I guess you're right. You know, it's been an interesting playoff. Certainly some teams that I had picked or I thought were favored to win are not in the playoffs now. You know, either one of these teams, you know, are capable of getting to the finals and or winning. But I'm going to go and say Miami.
Grant Hill of the Phoenix Suns, thanks so much.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Brooke Gladstone hosts On the Media, a weekly show on many NPR stations that is obviously not about sports or car repair. She says that she's always really wanted to write a comic book, and now she has, sort of, a graphic comic, as they're called, about media. Who are they? Or is it we? What do they do? How do they affect us? Is objectivity really possible? And even, is there a media, now that anyone with a cell phone can potentially reach millions of people directly? Brooke Gladstone's new book is called The Influencing Machine. It's illustrated by Josh Neufeld. And Brooke Gladstone, who, by the way, used to be our editor here on Weekend Edition, joins us from WNYC in New York. Brooke, thanks so much for being with us.
Long time no see.
So good to have you. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Well, this is a lot to go into, so let me try.
It sure is.
Yes. let me take it piece by piece. Can reporters be objective?
No. Reporters can be fair. This has always been a problem. Reporters can report things so they don't win the argument. But there's no way that we can divorce ourselves from the experience gleaned over a lifetime that forces us to come to certain conclusions. And nowadays, with the media enabling us to go to links anytime we want to primary sources, to all sorts of documents, people who follow the media today say that transparency and disclosure is the new objectivity. We don't have to pretend to be a monastic order of passionless priests in order to do the job of journalism.
Is there such a thing as the media?
It exists in our head. That's the influencing machine. Really, there is a media the same way that there is a human race. It's as varied and as enormous, but in certain contexts, you can look at it as a whole. And I think that the state of the media is and always has been mixed, as great as it's ever been and as awful as it's ever been.
So the greatest we've ever been, we'll assume it's your show. but at the same time, there are millions of people who are already functioning as their own journalists, aren't they? Their own media.
More and more all the time as their own curators, or they assemble a community of curators. I mean, people who don't understand Twitter, they think that it's just people talking about what they had for dinner. But more and more, it serves a curation purpose. People are using Twitter feeds and Twitter communities to deal with the problem of filtering that we have now, with so many streams of communication coming directly at us, unmediated by huge institutions. If your friends send you a link, you'll open it, you'll pass it on. Mm-hmm. You can get really informed that way, just as well informed as you would be, far better informed than reading most daily papers, because it's coming from everywhere, all around the world.
But let me point out the inevitable. How do you know it's true?
How do you ever know it's true? It is a matter of experience. Trust is built on experience. Your listeners trust you. Well, they trust you because you've proved to be trustworthy. This community of friends on Twitter, which is just one example, they get their followers because they've proved to be trustworthy. We saw this most explicitly during the so-called Arab Spring, where these communities came up and were able to really counter the lies of their own governments.
Is media, as we might think of at the moment, which is, in the best sense, seasoned professional journalists taking a look at the world directly, not just reading tweets, and reporting what they see, hear, and feel, is that going the way of buggy whip makers and telegraph operators?
No, I don't think so. I think journalists, professional journalists, will always be with us, and they'll always be on the ground. But they can be supplemented by ordinary people who are not paid for the journalism they do that supply eyewitness coverage, and they can find out who those trustworthy people are. Just because you get a paycheck doesn't necessarily mean that you are more trustworthy than somebody who is there out of conviction. And I think that is a change that is being wrought by the digital age. And I think that it's important for people to understand that objectivity per se is kind of a construct of a particular time and place, a short period in American history. Great journalism was done then, but great journalism was done before, and great journalism will be done after.
Brooke, so nice to talk to you.
Scott, thanks a lot.
Brooke Gladstone, who hosts On the Media, her new book, The Influencing Machine. It's illustrated by Josh Neufeld. Listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Stephen Sondheim wrote Broadway Baby in the early 1970s for Follies, the award-winning musical he created with James Goldman. But when Bernadette Peters sings the song, it could be a kind of anthem.
I'm just a Broadway.
A huge, rich revival of Follies is opened at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C., with the original orchestrations. As Peters plays Sally Durant Plummer, the one-time showgirl who attends a bittersweet reunion with her fellow performers and a cast that includes Elaine Page, Linda Lavin, and Regine. Bernadette Peters, who stopped more shows on Broadway than the Stagehands Union, joins us in our studios. Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here again.
All the featured roles you've played on Broadway, including several obviously noteworthy Sondheim roles. I mean, Annie Oakley, Mama Rose in Gypsy, Witch and Into the Woods. Where does Sally Durant Plummer fit in? How's she compare?
Oh, you know, what's great about it is that there's no comparison. I usually do things that are different and a challenge and interesting to me to approach. And this is a very interesting character, probably unlike any other character I've ever played, really.
And how so?
She is horribly disappointed with her life, comes back to the Follies Theater that she performed in 30 years ago, where she was the happiest in her life, and trying to recapture that happiness again, and I think she is, actually, that evening. And then it goes on and on to start crumbling around her and her huge disappointment.
The sun comes up, I think about you. The coffee cup, I think about you. I want you so. It's like I'm losing my mind.
Does this story reach you now in a way it might not have during the 1970s?
Oh, definitely, because I was really a kid. And even when I saw it, I think it was about 2000 there was a revival, maybe 2001. I hadn't read the script until about a year ago. And when I read it, I thought, this is just so heartbreaking, really. Not to say the show's not fun. The show's got lots of fun moments, and it's haunting, and it's gorgeous because they've come back to this old theater, and you notice ghostly, walking really slow, gorgeous showgirls. It's quite an interesting, beautiful show with some rip-roaring numbers, like you have Linda Lavin singing Broadway Baby, and you have Elaine Page bringing down the house singing I'm Still Here. And Regine bringing all her history. And then the rest of the cast is fantastic. Jan Maxwell and Ron Raines and Danny Burstein.
I've got those. God, why don't you love me? Oh, you do. I'll see you later, blues. That long as you ignore me, you're the only thing that matters, feeling. That if I'm good enough for you, you're not good enough.
When did the relationship with Stephen Sondheim begin? Looking back.
When I did Sunday in the Park with George, mm-hmm. I had always was aware of his shows, but I never thought I'd ever be in any of his shows.
What? Now why?
I don't know. I thought I wasn't a Sondheim girl. And then I got the call when I was performing at the Fairmont Hotel in San Francisco. James Lapine called me to say he wrote this new show with Stephen Sondheim and it's to play an artist model. And I thought, oh, this would be lovely to do.
And from the performer's point of view, what makes him a genius by such universal acclaim?
It's so hard to put into words. You know, when I went to see A Little Night Music before I was even knew I was going to be in it, mm-hmm. the music started and I went, oh my God, I can't believe the person that wrote all those other things also wrote this. The music is so beautiful, classical, in involved, intricate. But he is like an actor, but with notes and words. Mm-hmm. He creates what's necessary for the piece. Like an actor turns himself into another character. Mm-hmm. He does that with notes and music.
When did you first realize that you could sing?
You know, when I was a little girl, they said I had a funny voice because I actually had a deep voice. And that's because my mother didn't speak correctly and she had nodes that she had to have removed. So you grow up listening to your mother. And as years went on and I got out of that bad habit, my real voice revealed itself. And
you were talking like this or something?
As a little girl, yeah. And then as a teenager, I started singing soprano and I went, well, I can sing soprano. That's a surprise. And as you keep learning and growing and studying, your range, you know, grows and grows.
Is there a role you wish you could do over or do again?
Do over, do again. I usually, once I've done it, I've explored it. I stay for a long time in shows. I like to do that. You know, mm-hmm. I do it for like at least a year and then beyond that. And usually,
I mean, a lot of big stars like to get out after 3 or 4 months, right? They find that hard to do.
It depends how what your makeup is. If you're somebody that gets it and then thinks, you know, I've done it, I've gotten it now, and there's no place else to go. It depends on how you like to work. I like the run, and I like to keep going deeper and deeper and see what I can learn and experience about life.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
If I stick it long enough,
Bernadette Peters stars in Follies at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. through June 19th. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. We're still here. That's not news, really, except for those Christians who believe that Judgment Day should have started a few hours ago. The prophecy was that at 6 p.m. in each time zone across the globe, the truly faithful would ascend to heaven and the rest of humanity would begin 5 months of torment, ending with the end of everything. NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty has spoken with believers. We had a story on our program 2 weeks ago, and she's here with an update. Barbara, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
And remind us, why May 21?
Well, that date was calculated by a man named Harold Camping, who has a Christian radio network called Family Radio. He believes he's figured out the exact date of Noah's flood, and he says that from the date of the flood to May 21st, 2011, is exactly 7,000 years, which is apparently numerically and theologically significant. I should say that according to the Bible, Jesus said that no one knows the time or the date of his return, but Camping and the people who subscribe to his beliefs say that they have a certain esoteric knowledge that only God's elect can look at the Bible and see the writing on the wall, and they believe that they have. Now, I should also note, Scott, that Camping predicted that there would be devastating earthquakes all over the world, beginning in New Zealand, which is 16 hours ahead of us here in Washington, D.C., and we haven't seen that yet. He also predicted that up to 200 million people would be raptured or suddenly fly up to heaven, and I think that we would know if that had happened as well. So I think it's pretty safe to say that Judgment Day has been forestalled.
Tell us a little bit about these believers.
Well, it seems that they are a pretty eclectic group. I've talked to a couple of dozen people, including a guy who owns his own business, an author, a graphic designer, two people who work for the federal government, a couple of teachers, several military people. One man that I talked to is Brian Hobart, who does actuarial work for a large insurance company. I asked him how he could be so sure that May 21 was a date, and he said, well, you know, it's going to happen. I've crunched the numbers. Now, Brian is pretty representative of this ambivalence that a lot of these believers talk about. He's worried about his friends and his family, but he says he's really, really looking forward to Judgment Day. And this is what he told me.
I no longer think about 401ks and retirement. You know, I'm not stressed about losing my job, which a lot of other people are in this economy. I'm just a lot less stressed, and in a way, I'm more carefree.
But he is worried about his friends and family.
Right, there's a cost. I mean, many of these people are betting the farm that May 21st is it. Several people I've talked to have left their families, either voluntarily or two men I talked to. Their wives asked them to leave, and they have children, so that's really rather heartbreaking for them. Some people have not left their jobs. They follow Jesus' admonition to occupy till I come. But a lot of others have left their jobs, and they've spent their savings. One young couple I spoke with, Joel and Adrian Martinez, quit their jobs in New York, and they moved to Orlando, and they've spent the past year handing out doomsday pamphlets. And I asked them why they did this, and here's what they said.
You know, you think about retirement and stuff like that, but what's the point of just having some money just sitting there?
Yeah, I mean, we budgeted everything in a way that on May 21, we, you know, we won't have anything left.
I should note, Scott, that they have a 2-year-old daughter and they're expecting a baby in June.
Barbara, do we have any sense from history about what happens to people who bet everything on a doomsday prophecy?
Well, there have been, as you say, dozens of end times prophets, although most don't predict a particular date because that's kind of risky. But it does seem that people have various reactions when the prophecy fails. Some people just lose their faith altogether. Some say, well, look, our prayers worked. God decided to postpone Judgment Day. A lot of times people recalculate, and that's what Harold Camping did. He initially said that Judgment Day would come on September 6, 1994. And when that day came and went, he said, well, I wasn't completely positive. Plus, I hadn't looked at all the books of the Bible like Jeremiah, which has a lot to say about Judgment Day. And so he said, okay, I'm going to recalculate. And now, after this new research, he came back and said, now I am positive. It is May 21st, 2011. As he put it, there is no plan B.
Barbara, every time we do stories about people who hold this belief, we get complaints from people who say, why do you do stories about people like that?
I think we'd be remiss if we didn't. These people, there are billboards everywhere. There are caravans everywhere. People are handing out pamphlets. It's a news story. It's a religion news story. And I think I would not be doing my job if I wasn't reporting on this.
And NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.